This is The Book Show, and later tonight we're talking to filmmaker Ben Wheatley about his latest film, High Rise, which is based on J.G. Ballard's novel. We'll hear from Anna Kena Schofield about her second novel, Martin John. But first, we're looking at Scottish writing and identity. It's now 20 years since Renton, played by Ewan McGregor, in Danny Boyle's film Trainspotting, uttered these words. Listeners should bear in mind that as this is Irvine Welsh, there may be some strong language coming up.
It's shite being Scottish! We're the lowest of the low! The scum of the fucking earth! The most wretched, miserable, servile, pathetic trash that was ever shat into civilization. Some people hate the English, I don't. They're just wankers. We, on the other hand, are colonised by wankers. Can't even find a decent culture to be colonised by.
Scottish identity evolved in 2014 when just over half of the people voted in a referendum to remain part of the UK. As Britain plans another referendum on EU membership, the mainly pro-EU Scots question their nationhood once again. For Irvine Welsh, the man who wrote Trainspotting in 1993, Scottish identity has changed gradually over the years. It's not so much tied up with England anymore.
When I was growing up in the 70s, it was like people used to say things like, you know, it's like it's all the English's fault, the English have done this to us and all that. And it was like it was that very victim kind of blaming that the Scottish independence movement seemed to be into. And then it moved on to that kind of Renton phase, you know, where it's not the English, it's us, it's our own fault, that kind of, which is a progress in some ways, but it's also very kind of self-flagellating and ultimately kind of depowering. And then it's moved on to the new phase, which I think this is why it's kind of proliferated. It's that very pragmatic, it doesn't really matter whose fault it is. The point is to sort it out. You know, let's see what kind of nation we are, what kind of statehood we want.
Director of the Scottish Storytelling Centre in Edinburgh, Donald Smith, points to the centuries-long links between politics and literature.
There's a very long established tradition here of writers being pretty thoughtful nationalists, I would say. So I don't think that's a jingoist tradition. Burns would be very defining in that, a sense of left-leaning socialist nationalism, you know, a man's a man for all that, radical sense of politics, a specifically Scottish radicalism, and the sense that a national community and a national government in Scotland should be answerable to the needs, desires of the ordinary people of Scotland.
One of the giant figures of 20th century Scottish writing was the poet Hugh MacDiarmid. His long poem, A Drunk Man Looks at the Thistle, was published 90 years ago and is written in a mix of Scots dialects. It's modernist in the tradition of Eliot and Joyce and draws on the everyday and even cosmic in a search for identity, especially Scottish identity. Here, the radical poet dreams of a socialist Scotland in league with communist Russia.
But even as the stain the builders reject becomes the cornerstone, the time may be when Scotland shall find out its destiny and yield in the use of Shilovec. At all events, our Europe flaught atween my whim and mair than whim it pleases to seek the hand of Russia as a friend in working out mankind's great synthesis.
For writer Irvine Welsh, this poem is a major work of the 20th century, but the poet himself was full of contradictions.
He was a guy that was kind of thrown out of the SNP for being a communist and thrown out of the Communist Party for being in the SNP. And I mean, he came from Dumfries, which was probably in some ways the least sort of Scottish nationalistic part. And because he was on the border, I think he was in Langham, so because he was so close to the English border, I think that a lot of his nationalism came from that. And I think a lot of it, in some ways, a lot of MacDiarmid's nationalism, I think, was quite negative nationalism. I think it was, I always got a whiff of kind of anti-Englishness rather than pro-Scottishness about him. And I never really, I mean, I thought he was a great poet. I think he's obviously his seminal work is The Drunk Man Looks at the Thistle, which is fantastic kind of expose of Scottish identity and sort of almost like a kind of colonised mindset.
Another Scottish writer, Alan Warner, who wrote Morven Callor and more recently Their Lips Talk of Mischief, also reflects on Hugh MacDiarmid.
MacDiarmid's position is an important one because he was making clear that there was a division between a Anglo-Scottish mind and a Scottish mind, or self. And he reflected it not just through the Scottish treasury of poetry and through his own writing, but in a sense, in a political aspect as well, he emphasized it. So he was a pivotal figure who an irascible figure, and we needed a figure like that at the time, who was going to see a lot of things that upset people. But you need figures like that in literature, certain periods in the literature. And McDermott was the... It's impossible to think about 20th century literature and not take McDermott on board. And all the contradictions of McDermott, both a communist and a nationalist.
One writer who took on Scottish identity head first is James Kelman. Now in his 70th year, he's been hugely influential on the next generation of writers, including Irvin Welsh. Born into a working-class family in Glasgow, Kelman became very politically active and drew scorn from much of the London literary establishment. His 1994 novel, How Late It Was, How Late, won the Booker Prize, but his novel from 10 years earlier, The Bus Conductor, Hines, was very negatively received because the vocabulary in it was considered too true to life. Here's Alan Warner again.
His work was criticised for being the ravings of a mere bus conductor. I mean, that's an astonishing statement about a very, very artfully crafted novel, The Bus Conductor, Hines. And he met that kind of resistance, that kind of misunderstanding. So it's futile to deny that there's a resistance to that work. And why is there a resistance to that work? It's to do with received attitudes in England, really. I mean, that's where most of the misunderstanding came from. And a concept that profundity in art can't be created out of the daily speech of a people. And that's essentially, if you go back to McDermott, that's kind of the argument that's been taking place in Scottish literature, that you can express everything through daily spoken language for novelists, less so for poets. They're involved in other issues. So those conflicts are the ones that still emerge. There's still misunderstanding about it. We couldn't have had my generation of writers if Kelman hadn't broken down a lot of barriers and fought through a lot of misunderstandings himself. You know, he cleared the way for us in so many ways.
He took a lot of the flack, basically, Jim, so that people like myself could have more fun. You know, he was put in this position of being this very kind of serious political guy and about the being this kind of the poster boy for Scottish kind of writing and Scottish language and all that. And he had to continually kind of fight these kind of wars, basically, because he was very isolated at that time. I mean, he had people like Tom Leonard was using the same kind of vernacular structures in poetry and all that. But as a novelist, Jim was very much out there, and he had to kind of... I think he gave people like myself acceptance, really, in a way, that because he'd paved that way. You know, he'd kind of gone down that path and said that this is what I'm doing, this is how I'm writing, and this is why I write the way that I write. And he'd kind of he'd set up a kind of template, in a way, not so much a template for people to follow like myself linguistically, but he'd set up a kind of a procedural kind of template about how you should handle that, how you should handle the criticism of that, and what kind of criticism you're likely to have.
Being a Scottish writer is about building on the literary tradition of McDermott and Kelman to find an identity. And Alan Warner says that the results of the 2014 referendum hasn't changed that.
That project, that concept of discovering an identity and building an identity and trying to maintain that identity, be it a writer in Gaelic or be it a novelist in Edinburgh, has kept writers energised. We feel that we are doing something that's valuable, identifying a culture and preserving that culture.
Back at the Storytelling Centre, director Donald Smith celebrates the puzzling and complex challenge of discovering a modern Scotland by quoting a passage from Liz Lockhead's 1987 play, Mary, Queen of Scots, Got Her Head Chopped Off.
Country, Scotland, what like is it? It's a peat bog, it's a dark forest. It's a cauldron of lye, a salt pan or a coal mine. If you're guy lucky, it's a brick beer meadow or a park of kye, or maybe it's a field of stains,
It's a tenement or a merchant's hall. It's a whorehouse or a humble cot, Prince's Street or Peddy's Market. It's a fistful of fish or a pickle of oatmeal. It's a queen's banquet or roast meats and junkets. It depends, it depends. I dinna ken what, like, your Scotland is. It's inquiry and celebration and bafflement and frustration and exaltation, all in one.
And thanks there to Irvine Welch, Alan Warner and Donald Smith for their thoughts on Scottish national identity. Now, Anna Cana Schofield's debut novel, Malarkey, was published in 2013, and it portrayed a complicated relationship between a mother and her son. In her second novel, Martin John, the title character has just left his home in the west of Ireland to live in London. With him, he brings his dark problems. Here, Anna Cana Schofield reads from Martin John.
He would leave the bathroom door unlocked. He would want her to walk in on him, whether he was bathing or not. Once, she found him on top of the toilet seat cover yanking at his parts. When she stuttered an apology, "God, sorry," and "lock the door," he stared her in the eye and pulled even harder at the exposure below. Like it didn't matter whether she was there or not, he'd carry on.
And that was Anna Cana Schofield reading from her novel Martin John about a sexual predator. Anna Cana, I guess when people read this book, they're going to feel a mixture of revulsion and sympathy for the main character. So why did you write the book from Martin John's point of view?
Well, technically, it's actually from the mother and Martin John's point of view, because Martin John religiously hears his mother's voice in his head. But I actually wanted to challenge myself, and I wanted to try to get into the head and the kidneys, if you like, of a man who's so very far from anything I know or have lived.
When you say that, I mean, what you do is you bring the reader into his head, and we're forced to recognise that this is a guy that we could have grown up with or worked with or lived beside. And was that intentional?
Absolutely. There was a number of things I wanted to explore in Martin John. The first thing is this notion that sexual deviants or sex offenders, or as I refer to Martin John, he's really a simple-minded molester. They're not some distant aberration. They are beside you on the bus. They are at your kitchen table. And I wanted to confront that with the literary tools that I have, which are our form and language. And because Martin John is also quite mentally ill, he operates on this cycle or system of circuits and loops and refrains. And this was a formal conceit where I could explore the cycle of complicity, I could explore the cycle of reoffending, I could think about the circular nature of mental illness. There was just so much that I could get at, if you like.
In the acknowledgements at the end of the book, you do say that you've consulted specialists and health workers. What did you learn from that research, and how did it feed into the character of Martin John?
Well, I want to be clear that Martin John can only ever be defended as a piece of literature. So I'm very loath to speak as some kind of pop-up expert, which I'm absolutely not, on deeply complicated, complex issues. But I did have some communication with a wonderful forensic psychiatrist in Ottawa, where they have a sexual offenders clinic. And the first thing, I had two or three email exchanges with Dr. Paul Fedoroff, and the first thing I learned, to my surprise, was that the efficacy of treatment is actually quite good, because I think the public perception is there's just absolutely no hope, and sex offenders and people with those kinds of deeply disturbing and criminal urges are beyond hope, and they should be castrated, or they should be murdered or killed or whatever. But in actual fact, the main thing I've learned from him is, you know, you don't need to commit a crime to get help. And Paul Fedoroff referred me, when I wrote to him towards the end, and I said, I'm really, really struggling with the fact that these men have no remorse, it seems. He wrote back to me and said, no, you're wrong. And he referred me to a work called Psychopathia Sexualis, which was, I think, published in the late 1800s. And I think it was written by a Russian doctor. And he recorded every possible perversion that he encountered in his practice. And so when I went and I read that, I realized, well, these problems are not new. They are actually not invented by the internet, as we tend to imagine they might be. That when you go back and you read, you realize that at some point we do need to confront the deep psychosexual problems in our societies.
the other voice, of course, that we hear in the book is Martin John's mother, who's Mam, and she's not always straightforward either. In fact, she doesn't always want to deal with his behaviour, and at other times she says she'll set the police on him. But tell me about her.
I suppose I'm interested in the darker side of motherhood, and motherhood is complicated, and no mother comes to parenthood or no father with, you know, training. And I mean, I suppose I just had deep empathy for her. How else would she know how to respond? I think she's also very much a product of the 70s and the 80s and that secrecy and shame, deep shame that people did feel in Ireland about anything like this, anything really to do with the body or sin. Or she just really cannot face the reality of the behaviour of her son. So, you know, she dispatches him to London and then she just issues these decrees. And basically her approach is, you know, just stop it.
When I read Malarkey, I was really struck by the mother in that book. And I wondered, because of the way women and Irish mammies and Irish mothers have been represented in Irish fiction, was this your attempt to sort of, you know, of skewing that, of doing something different, of sort of, you know, writing all of that imbalance, those sort of the cliches?
There's definitely a riposte to some of the depictions of women that bother me. And then the mother is, to some extent, a victim as well. She's just very practical. And, you know, I'm interested in kind of practical women. And I love that about Ireland. I love that about Irish women. I come from a long line of very practical, hardy, you know, farming women, which isn't to endorse the attitude or the approach that this particular woman takes. The other thing that I think really informed me about the women, strangely, you know how in fiction, it's not always coming from what you're writing about. So one of the notions I had of Martin John being sent away to London actually came from the dispatching of the so-called fallen woman. So a young woman or a woman that would have been unmarried and fallen pregnant. There's a long history of these women being shipped out and then shipped out to give birth and then brought back. And so in some ways I was kind of inverting that with this situation where the son is obviously very, very dangerous and she just doesn't know what to do, so she just ships them away.
And thanks to Anna Kena Schofield, and her novel Martin John is published by And Other Stories. Now we find ourselves on the 25th floor of a high-rise building.
For all its inconveniences, Lang was satisfied with life in the high-rise, ready to move forward and explore life. How exactly? He had not yet decided.
I'm so sorry.
I'll survive.
I thought you were empty.
I just moved in.
You're an excellent specimen. Why don't you come up later and have a drink?
That's a clip from a new film of J.G. Ballard's 1975 novel, High Rise. And the novel's opening lines set the tone for the book. Here they are. Later, as he sat on his balcony eating the dog, Dr. Robert Lang reflected on the unusual events that had taken place within this huge apartment building during the previous 3 months. And those unusual events refer to the collapse of society, maybe even all of civilization, in a block of flats in England. And the novel, as the opening line suggests, shows graphically what can happen when people stop observing the rules. Now it's been adapted by writer Amy Jump and directed by Ben Wheatley. And I met with Ben recently and wanted to know where he'd first come across J.G. Ballard's novel, High Rise.
I read it when I was probably about 15, 16, and it was with a load of books like Naked Lunch and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and was a kind of intro into counterculture. I mean, I remember at the time the kind of weird radiation that was coming off of Ballard, that he was kind of a scary, dangerous writer, and to a kind of 15, 16-year-old, that was exactly what I wanted to read. But I think my feelings about Ballard changed, you know, as I got older, and my experience of reading Ballard as a 40-year-old man with a kid was very different from when I was a callow youth who was just interested in all the violence and anarchy of the book. And when I looked at it again, I just found, you know, it had that thing of, because it's a predictive fiction, unfortunately, he got many things right. That kind of started me down the road of wanting to make it into a film.
No matter how civilized we think that we all are, sometimes there's a sense that people can often revert to their more base, sort of more animalistic sort of level. What is the catalyst for the breakdown of the social structure in High Rise?
The breakdown is very small, you know, and it can start from just a button not working on a lift. And it basically, builds up into kind of a series of irritations that kind of give everyone in the block the permission to go crazy. And I think that's that was the interesting thing, and that they would embrace it so thoroughly that they weren't needed to be nudged that much. And I think what's interesting about the book is that it doesn't hang about, you know, it's pretty much, it goes from being organised in the building to being feral in about 20 pages, you know.
In the film, Tom Hiddleston plays the role of Dr. Robert Langan, who moves into the building, and he adjusts to the chaos almost immediately. It's sort of, he gets swept up in all the madness. And I wonder, is that a comment about any of us, that it could happen very easily to each and every one of us?
Yeah, I think it's more like, I mean, I remember that when the banking crisis happened, and I was reading about it, and that if they hadn't have like pulled the plugs on the computers in the States, it would have auto traded us into a kind of complete bankruptcy, and we'd have gone in on Monday morning to use our cash cards, and they wouldn't have worked. And then, you know, was it, they say we're only a couple of meals away from anarchy. You know, I'm about 18 stone, so I'm about an afternoon away from anarchy usually. You know, so it's. I felt that, you know, and we started thinking, well, Jesus, we've got nothing in our house at all. We've got no food, really. We buy it every couple of days, you know. So if something went wrong, it would very quickly go pretty ugly, I think.
Jeremy Irons plays a mysterious architect called Anthony Royal, and he lives in the penthouse with his wife. And there is a lot of hierarchy, not just in terms of people, but also the floors of the building in the film. The building for him is a social experiment, and he admits that it has a lot of flaws. But do you think of him as a sort of mad scientist, or is that too literal an interpretation of his character?
I think there's lots of different levels that you can look at all this stuff. I mean, the building is a metaphor in itself, and it's not necessarily just a comment on post-war housing, you know. So I think, and for me, the building can be a building, or it can be a country, or it can be the world, or it can be a man or a woman as well. So, and you know, caught within yourself and fighting within yourself. So there are all those interpretations inside it, and whether Royal the architect is kind of God, or is shown as he has the arrogance of a man who thinks he can control people, is kind of up for grabs a little bit.
The actual building itself in the film is this sort of giant, brutalist sort of structure. It's very imposing. And there's a sense that the building is a character very much in the film. So how did you go about creating that sense of building as character in this work?
We looked at the spaces, and we wanted the walls and the buttresses of each of the apartments to feel like they were imposing on the people. And this had come out of a thing where I'd stayed in a hotel in Denmark, and it had a pillar in the middle of the room and loads of wires and stuff, and it's like they didn't care about the people who were staying in the building, but they just cared about how the building was built, and I thought that was really interesting. And I think it would be typical of Royal that he wouldn't really care how the people had to deal with the building, and he was more interested in its construction, you know, and his grand experiment. So we paid a lot of attention to these, making these difficult spaces within the building.
How did you approach point of view in terms of looking at longer passages in the book and then translating that into a script, and in terms of who's talking and what we actually hear?
So it's more of a question for Amy Jump, who wrote the script, you know, and there's a kind of a cliche idea of how the director works with the writer. And I think it's come out of Hitchcock, where he kind of, you know, he made it very well known that he kind of wrote the treatments with his wife and then got other people to write them up. But the way an Amy and I work is not like that. You know, I don't have any input into how she writes. You know, I kind of look in the office and say, have you finished? And she says, go away. And this goes on for about, you know, 6 or 7 weeks, and then I get the finished script and I read it and enjoy it.
What do you think is the key to a successful adaptation of a book?
We wanted to make sure that we got the essence of the book and as much of the story of the book within the film. There are obviously massive differences between the two forms, and so you have one which is that if you put everything in a book into a film, the film's 5 hours long and people get cross. And then the other one is that a film is absolutely literal. You know, when you see a room, you see everything in the room. And in literature, the author carefully paces you through all those details, and you make a kind of a picture in your mind of what that room would be like. But then he or she can introduce other elements into it, and you're not surprised by that because you're being guided through it. But in the film, you don't have that luxury. So things that may work in a book visually will not work in a film. So I think we had to sift through that and find what the safest route through was. I didn't go back to the book with High Rise. I worked solely from her script.
And thanks there to Ben Wheatley. High Rise, the movie, is on release from March 18th. But if you want to read the novel by J.G. Ballard, it's published by Fourth Estate. Well, that's all we've time for this evening. Remember to keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter at BookshowRTE. Thanks to the production team, producer Regan Hutchins, and series producer Zoe Cummins.